Hi, everyone. Welcome to our next episode of Mind the Meds, the neurology pharmacy focused podcast from Pharmacy Times. This episode is coming out the first week of June 2026, which means, from my definition, summer is here. Kids are out of school, which means traffic is lighter and my commute is better. The nights are longer, all that good stuff. And actually, on the day this comes out, I will be helping out with our town's annual chalk art festival, which honestly always marks the beginning of summer for me personally. It's this very cool event that I have been on the planning committee for almost 10 years now. We have over 200 people come out and they're assigned squares right on Main Street to chalk on. And it's just really fun to see the art and all the people that come out to either participate or just walk the street and look at everything. So I say this just as a plug to get involved in your community in something completely outside of pharmacy if or when you have the bandwidth to do so, because it's been really rewarding for me. And if it's not something that you can do right now for a million valid reasons, I definitely recommend just looking for some fun events in your area that you can check out this summer to stay connected. So enough of me blathering on. We have another packed episode this month. We had our first episode last month. That was kind of a special format, but I'm going to transition now to what I'm planning to continue on in future episodes, which is me doing a brief kind of overarching news highlights for about 5 to 10 minutes and then moving into a discussion with our special guest or guests for the episode. So let's get into it. First, a disclaimer, anyone in the space knows that I can't possibly cover all the news from the last month in 5 to 10 minutes, but these are things that I came across either scrolling newly published articles on PubMed or from news blasts throughout the month that I thought would be of interest to a broad audience. First, a couple things that came out of ESOC 2026, that stands for the European Stroke Organization Conference, which occurred May 6th to 8th at a place in the Netherlands that looked beautiful, but I'm not going to say because I don't want my poor pronunciation skills to live on in this podcast in perpetuity. So big article or big data out of there on asundexian, which is the factor 11A inhibitor that it's been honestly all over the news recently in terms of neurology news anyways. Pharmacy Times does have an on-demand webinar if you'd like to learn more about this and other emerging therapies in the space, since I don't have time to review everything. But specifically what came out of the conference is data that as secondary stroke prevention, this drug not only reduced the risk of recurrent ischemic stroke without any increased risk of bleeding, which is crazy, but also that the recurrent strokes that did occur in trials were less severe. So 22.9% on drug versus 30.3% on placebo, and less likely to be disabling, 2.1% on drug versus 3% on placebo. And I'd invite you to review the data if you want exactly what scales they used for that info. So really kind of important. And as more data comes out on this drug, it certainly seems like we could have a game changer coming out later this year. The back of my mind just hopes it's accessible from a cost perspective, because it really does seem like it could be really important to a lot of patients. Also out of ESOC was actually a lot of data on tyrosinase, which is a glycoprotein 2B3A antiplatelet drug. It's commonly used or has its FDA approval right now in acute coronary syndromes. Results from actually 3 different trials were presented at ESOC, and each had positive results. So very briefly, we had the INSTANT trial, which showed tyrosinase's potential to improve outcomes in patients with inadequate response to initial thrombolytic therapy. The ATTRACTION trial used tyrosinase as an adjunct after a successful endovascular thrombectomy, but to address the subset of patients that still are unable to achieve functional independence despite success in that procedure. And the tyrosinase did improve functional outcomes. And ATTILA looked at use of tyrosinase in tandem lesion stroke, where you have a blockage of the extracranial carotid artery and an intracranial vessel at the same time. So bad news. Tyrosinase in this situation decreased acute instant thrombosis rates versus its comparator intravenous aspirin. So three positive trials will definitely be on the lookout for perhaps more data in more diverse populations on tyrosine, but it seems to me that there could be an expanded role for this drug in acute ischemic stroke. I'll also talk about some updates in MS today. So big news for MS this month was the approval of Ocrevus, notably IV only right now, for children aged 10 and older with relapsing remitting MS who weigh at least 55 pounds. Approval was based on the Operetta 2 trial, which was a non-inferiority trial versus fingolimod. I'm not even going to try and tape over that because I say that wrong every time. And while this was a non-inferiority trial versus sfingolimod, Ocrevus did show greater reductions in disease activity and better tolerability than sfingolimod. Now, I encourage everyone to review the dosing on this because smaller kids will be on lower induction and maintenance doses. Anyone 35 kilograms and greater, though, will follow the same dosing as what we're used to for adults. Hand in hand, kind of, with that news is a trial that lends to the growing body of evidence for use of high-efficacy agents like Ocrevus early in the disease course. In their article published in Neurology, this will actually be in the June 23rd issue, but it's available online now, Sharman and colleagues explored this actually for children through the lens of preventing long-term disability. Their conclusions being that, quote, in children aged 12 to 17 years with MS, initiating therapy with monoclonal antibodies before age 18 versus age 20 to 22, so once they're in adulthood, is associated with less disability accrual between the ages of 23 and 27. So now that Ocrevus has this FDA approval for pediatrics, articles like this could be really good to have in your arsenal if any insurance issues arise. Actually, we saw a number of articles with ocrelizumab in the past month. In The Lancet in May, Hauser and colleagues published results from Musette and Gavotte trials. These took a look at body weight adjusted higher dosing of ocrelizumab, one in relapsing patients and one in primary progressive patients, and its effect on disability progression to have that higher body weight adjusted dosing. In both populations, though, high-dose ocrelizumab failed to further improve disability progression. So we're still in this era of progressive, progression independent of relapse activity, and it doesn't look like high-dose Ocrevus is going to be the answer to that. Also in the Lancet, also another trial for ocrelizumab, we had Oratorio Hand from Giovannoni, I'm going to go with that, and colleagues, which aimed to include a broader and likely more representative group of primary progressive MS patients than the original Oratorio trial. It actually attained that by including 27% of their patients were 55 and older, and 16% of patients had an EDSS score, so a disability score of greater than 6.5. Both of these criteria would have excluded these patients' participation in the original Oratorio trial. This trial did confirm benefit in delaying disability progression in this broader population of primary progressive patients, which could be helpful data to pull out if you're ever having discussions with older or more advanced primary progressive MS patients and they're kind of on the fence about starting treatment. And finally, I do want to talk about PADOVA, which was a phase 2B RCT for use of IV prasinezumab. For those who don't know, prasinezumab is a monoclonal antibody that selectively binds the C-terminal of aggregated alpha-synuclein, with the aim of clearing the pathogenic aggregated alpha-synuclein while leaving healthy forms alone. PADOVA looked at the use of this drug in early-stage Parkinson's patients who were on stable symptomatic monotherapy. The primary endpoint was time to a confirmed motor progression event, so a greater than or equal to 5-point increase in the MDS-UPDRS, part 3 off-medication score, which is an appropriate outcome. This trial did not meet the primary endpoint. It joins the earlier phase 2 trial Pasadena of this drug, which also did not meet its primary endpoint. Now, there have been non-significant trends and exploratory evidence that still suggests benefit, so we'll have to wait for more results, and there is an ongoing phase 3 Paraiso trial. In my opinion, it's really unclear right now if this is a matter of still needing to find the right patient population and endpoints, or if we have a failed compound. It certainly would be lovely to have something that is disease-modifying in the Parkinson's space, but more to come on prasinezumab. Okay, so that is all the news I have time for. Now we're going to move on to our special topic and guest for the episode. Today, our special topic is all about Alzheimer's disease because there are actually a few things that have come up in this space in the last month or so. We have a new medication approved for agitation due to Alzheimer's called Auvelity, an update on Leqembi iClick for initiation doses, and a Cochrane review on anti-amyloid therapies as a whole that deserves some airtime. To help us in our discussion today is my guest, Dr. Milad Sobhanian. I'm going to let him introduce himself here in a minute, but I'm really excited to have him on today. And that excitement is in part because I honestly cannot believe my luck in finding Milad in time for this discussion. As I was planning topics for today's episode, I knew Alzheimer's had a lot going on, but there just aren't a lot of pharmacists that work in this space. So when I met Milad, honestly, just a couple weeks ago doing a panel on a different topic, and he happened to mention that he works with anti-amyloid therapies, I immediately had the idea to ask him to be on this podcast, and he so graciously agreed, even given him like a very short timeline. So I can't thank you enough, Milad, for being on. And yeah, why don't we start with just a little intro on you?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for inviting me on. So as you said, I'm Milad Sobhanian. I'm a clinical pharmacy specialist in neurology. I work at the University of Maryland, and I'm embedded in our outpatient neurology clinic. I work with our patients, of course, starting anti-amyloid therapy for Alzheimer's, as well as a few other neurology subspecialties.
Okay, awesome. Sounds like a very busy but rewarding practice out there.
Sure is.
So a few things to discuss here in the Alzheimer's space. We're first going to discuss a new medication for agitation specifically in Alzheimer's. So a little bit of context here for all of our listeners. Agitation is really one of the most common and clinically significant neuropsychiatric symptoms in Alzheimer's disease, affecting up to 60% of patients over the course of the illness. And unfortunately, prevalence increases alongside disease severity, which is not the line on the graph we like to see. But when I say agitation, because often a caregiver might not describe certain things as agitation, I want to make sure we're talking, the umbrella of symptoms we're talking about are things like inappropriate verbal, vocal, or motor activity, including restlessness, pacing, shouting, hitting, kicking, and actively resisting care. So because this gets more prevalent, like I said, as the disease gets more severe and is linked to things like earlier admission to nursing homes, it's really important to address this. Now, our current treatment model has a large focus on non-pharmacologic interventions. These are first line, and this is probably not going to be a big spoiler to anyone, but that's really not going to change, even with this new agent approved. But different types of therapies like touch therapy and music therapy, tailored programs for the patient and caregiver education and skills training. We really move on to our pharmacologic therapy when these things have failed or behavior poses a danger to either the patient or to others like their caregivers. So for a while, as far as pharmacologic therapy, we relied on off-label options, which is, of course, you know, it's not uncommon in neuro and any other areas where you practice medicine. But in this space, we're looking at mostly atypical antipsychotics and things like SSRIs, citalopram specifically having the most data. In other agitation states, we might think of benzos, maybe even as an initial therapy, but generally try to avoid in this population for obvious safety reasons. And all of these off-label options really are still used today as they can be accessed very easily. But in 2023, we got our first FDA-approved therapy, a brand name Rexulti or brexpiprazole, which is an atypical antipsychotic, and it's marketed as essentially a better-tolerated aripiprazole. Now, Milad, what are things that you think about when considering using pharmacologic therapy, some of these available treatments in an Alzheimer's patient?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as you said, these are not therapies that we should be reaching for, you know, first line. These patients are often have to go through the systemic approach and the stepwise approach of non-pharmacologic intervention. If we've gotten to the point where the symptoms are severe and they're not really responding to those other interventions, then we can reach for some of these therapies like, you know, our antipsychotics and benzodiazepines. When you look at antipsychotics, of course, we can't ignore the kind of the glaring black box warning of increased mortality risk in patients with dementia. And particularly that's the population that we're working with.
Exactly.
you know, if you're working through, if you're looking at the data and the outcomes, I think, you know, the biggest reasons for mortality or cause for mortality, you know, sudden cardiac death, heart failure, infections, including pneumonia being the most common. So, you know, kind of looking at your patient, looking at their past medical history and determining which, you know, if they have any of these potentially underlying causes like heart failure or arrhythmias or something, that you want to be extremely careful with, you know, including these therapies and starting these therapies for these patients. You know, I think, and this, I'm not sure, you know, if in your practice you see this too, but with, you know, brexpiprazole, you know, we do have to be, I think we're a little bit more excited to use this therapy because it has the on-label indication, but we do need to be aware and mindful that it's still an atypical antipsychotic. And so we can't ignore the potential risk of increased mortality. So, you know, we do tend to reserve these therapies after everything else has failed. But those are some of the things that we keep in mind, is that how we follow the appropriate, you know, standard in terms of getting them on the therapy that they need safely.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way that you're thinking about that. And so exciting, because Auvelity is our new agent in the game. It was approved just on April 30th of this year to treat agitation associated with dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. That's its on-label indication, the wording there. This is actually the second approved indication for this agent. It's been around originally since August of 2022, when it was approved for major depressive disorder. So it's been a little, it's been here around a little while, but a new indication, a new labeled indication. This is actually a combination product, and at its maintenance dosing, it has dextromethorphan 45 milligrams and bupropion 105 milligrams, and it's a twice a day medication. What I think might be surprising to some is that the rationale for its use in Alzheimer's agitation is really focused on the dextromethorphan component. The bupropion here is really being used as for its CYP2D6 inhibition to increase and sustain the dextromethorphan levels. And so, yeah, that I feel like that does, you know, you have to wrap your head around that, because in other indications like depression, bupropion probably does play an active role, but not so much here. Now, dextromethorphan in its role is an uncompetitive antagonist of the NMDA receptor. And this is the main mechanism where it could be helpful in Alzheimer's agitation, because there is excessive glutamatergic stimulation at this receptor in Alzheimer's, which has been directly linked to behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. And so a lot of promise when this drug was getting developed, and excited to see an indication, because this does offer a novel mechanism from what we've been using off-label or on-label with Rexulti in the past. Now, I think that most pharmacy folks are familiar with these two products similarly, both things that have been around for a long time. But can you give us, Milad, what I call kind of the package insert rundown for this new drug? Highlights on like side effects, drug interactions, things we should know before we recommend this drug, specifically in an Alzheimer's agitation patient.
I think, you know, I like the, you know, you talking about the interaction and sort of that leveraging of the inhibition that you get with the substrate and the inhibitor of, you know, the substrate being dextromethorphan, the inhibitor being bupropion. So I think that's a good place to start. You know, inhibiting 2D6, you think of our antidepressants, you know, like fluoxetine, some of our SSRIs. So if your patient's already taking one of those medications, you may want to be mindful of their dosage, and you may consider a dose adjustment there. You know, you mentioned NMDA antagonism is a primary mode of action for the dextromethorphan component. Another therapy that we use for symptomatic management of Alzheimer's disease is Namenda or memantine, which is also an NMDA receptor antagonist. So using the two in concert, you may see, you know, you may still maintain a therapeutic benefit, but you may push a patient over a little bit more into too much NMDA antagonist, which can result in certain adverse effects like dizziness and headache and the like. You know, other considerations from a, you know, tolerability and safety standpoint, bupropion is not typically the first medication that I think of is starting in an elderly patient. It's an SDNRI, so selective dopamine norepinephrine a reuptake inhibitor. So those are, you know, these sort of catecholamines. They have the sympathetic effects. Tachycardia, hypertension is, of course, concerning a risk factor, especially if patients are already have some underlying hypertension and arrhythmia to begin with. You know, cardiovascular history is another consideration. And of course, bupropion, I think all pharmacists are really going to be like, oh, seizure history. That's the number one thing. So it can lower seizure threshold. The doses that are used, you know, 200 milligrams a day, 100 to 200 milligrams a day, depending on, you know, where they are in the titration. Those typically aren't the ones that we worry about in terms of seizure history. Usually, if you look at the outcome data, you know, older data, 300 to 400 milligrams a day of bupropion seems to be the dose associated. So we may not be getting to that point, but still in an elderly patient, using caution there. And of course, renal impairment. If their kidneys don't work, they can't clear the medication. So you need to either adjust or avoid depending on their EGFR. And the cutoffs are listed pretty clearly in the labeling. So I think those are the big things that I would consider with this therapy, you know, as it comes to market.
Yeah, I love how you stressed the idea of kind of additive side effects, because I feel like especially with a combination product, everyone, like including pharmacists, can fall into a trend of calling a combination product by its brand name instead of by the generic components. And where you have a drug like this, where it's you could easily see a patient already on bupropion. You could easily see a patient, you know, requesting to get some dextromethorphan from the pharmacy for a cough, mm-hmm. you know, or you can easily see someone already on memantine. And so it's going to be really important, I think, as this comes to use, to really review patients' medication list and make sure there's none of that kind of additive stuff happening. So I love that you brought that up. Now, as far as efficacy, which we have to look at, of course, and we don't have a ton of time, but they had a study that took a look at the difference between active drug and placebo in the Cohen-Mansfield Agitation Inventory, or the CMAI, which is an appropriate endpoint. This is a primary endpoint that's been used validated in a lot of studies as far as Alzheimer's agitation. But it was a relatively short trial at 5 weeks. And like I said, we only really have time for a top line review of the results. They did show a reduction of 14.9 points on the CMAI scale in the treated group versus an 11.6 point drop in the placebo group. So a least squares mean difference of 3.3 points. You know, as an obviously indirect comparison, but I always feel like I need to compare things in my mind. Yeah. We did have a longer 12-week studies in our other approved drug, brexpiprazole, 2 or 3 milligrams. So there's a little difference in dosing based on these studies. But that did show a least squares mean change of 3.8 to 5.3 points compared to placebo, depending on the study you looked at and the dose. And in clinical context, as another indirect comparison, a 2024 study showed that a meaningful within-patient change in CMAI is somewhere between 15 to 25 points. So, you know, we have a mean difference from placebo of 3.3, maybe up to 5.3 in Rexulti, where a meaningful within-patient change is somewhere between 15 to 25 points. This is, you know, but it's such a touchy area because agitation is something that is sometimes subjective, and sometimes you want to do anything you can. So I have conflicting thoughts on this. Milad, what are your thoughts?
I'm right there with you. I mean, I think this is really why we really want to make sure that we're looking at, you know, all of the tools in our tool belts, right? Relying on those, you know, non-pharmacologic interventions first, educating the caregivers and the provider to identify, we'll recognize what agitation looks like. And then, is this because of some other reason? Like, are they hungry? Is there a change in their schedule or routine? Do they have a UTI that needs to be treated? These medications shouldn't be what we reach for first. Because as you rightfully pointed out, the outcomes aren't particularly robust, but it's something, right? And if we've gone through all of the treatment options, there are risks that we've already mentioned, like the risk of mortality with the antipsychotics, which, even though brexpiprazole was not necessarily included in that analysis, it's still an atypical antipsychotic, so we can't ignore the risk that's there. And I mentioned, the cardiovascular risk with the bupropion component of this combination product. So they're not totally benign therapies either. So I think, it just reinforces that idea of sort of just, we should look at what we have first and then work our way through the list, really.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like I said earlier, it's not a huge spoiler, but this doesn't automatically jump to the top of the algorithm for agitation treatment. So that is, I want to be able to get to a few other discussion things, but that's Auvelity for Alzheimer's agitation. We kind of already touched on this, but any other thoughts as to what this might add to our arsenal, or when do you potentially see it, definitely avoided or potentially being used? When might you reach for this?
We've kind of, I think we're on the same page, but certainly something that you might consider, later in the treatment algorithm. It may be a decision of, brexpiprazole, other antipsychotics versus this medication. This might be for a patient who doesn't have any other comorbid conditions that you'd be concerned about using the combination product in, maybe a little bit, healthier otherwise, versus your antipsychotic. So I could see that being where it falls in as a decision of A versus B, and also access. I'm not sure what this is going to look like, but I can't imagine it'll be a very affordable option. And I'm not sure if we get the 105 milligram bupropion in a tablet form. So we might have to mix and match some things and be creative if we need to kind of get the combination into somebody that can't get the Auvelity, assuming antipsychotics are not on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a very, very robust summary. So thank you. And now we're going to move on to our next line of discussion, still in the Alzheimer's space, like you mentioned. I was kind of excited. I thought that this podcast was, second month, and I really was just like killing it, because this is going to fall right in line with the original PDUFA date for Leqembi sub-Q or Leqembi iClick for initiation dosing. But I actually heard that decision has been delayed. Did you hear that too? And the reasons were on that?
I haven't seen any particularly specific reasons, but what I've gathered and our MSLs have sort of, our local MSLs have sort of hinted at, it does seem like the FDA wants more information on specifics in terms of dosing, because it's a subcutaneous, so you change bioavailability, as well as differences in potentially monitoring changes. So you're getting potentially more drug into the patient because of the weekly injections. And so what comes with that certainly would be a concern for increased risk of ARIA. So there, those changes, I think they wanted a little bit more clarity on, and to review the data that they had before they made a decision. And honestly, I thought the initial turnaround was pretty quick. So I'm not totally opposed to them taking their time with their final decision, and hopefully final decision in August.
Yeah. A delay of 3 months is, if it takes that time, it takes that time. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, notably, iClick is already approved for maintenance doses. But I feel like, often when people think of maintenance dosing, you think of maybe like 6 weeks of loading or but for this drug that starts at 18 months, right? So that means 18 months of IV infusions before switching to a vastly more convenient subcutaneous formulation. So was this delay, I know we mentioned for safety reasons, but have you already had to kind of tell people, patients rather, it was delayed? Have you had patients switch to iClick thus far, and are they excited? And so some patients are a little bit bummed about the delay.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I talk to patients, you know, before we initiate therapy, and you know, as it stands, you know, I talk about the options that are available, and oftentimes we see patients tend to favor the donanemab infusion a little bit more because it's an IV monthly versus biweekly, you know, every 2 weeks, and there's a potential completion date. So the subcutaneous we were excited for because patients could just start it at home; they don't have to worry about this, like, you know. In you know, almost inconvenient, like every 2 weeks infusion regimen. And so, you know, in my discussions with patients, we have a few lecanemab patients that are at that, you know, threshold of transitioning to the monthly infusion versus the subcutaneous. The small number that have actually transitioned over opted for the monthly infusions. So I don't have too many that actually want to proceed with the subcutaneous injection. And it makes sense, you know, in this population, maybe you don't want to change too many things. You've established the routine, you're comfortable with it. So that's kind of where we stand. You know, I think having this as another option though was going to be very exciting because that's much more convenient. I've had patients tell me I don't want to come in and do infusions. I'd rather do it at home. And so having that, though it does introduce a few you know, questionable things with monitoring issues, when it comes
Absolutely.
to keeping up with MRIs and ARIA symptoms and all that, where we don't have as much oversight like we do at the infusion center.
Yeah, definitely. Once it is approved, because the signals I'm seeing are that it likely will be approved after this further analysis, but it will definitely begin the questions of the appropriate patient population and perhaps caregiver support at home that will be necessary to find a good candidate to do
Absolutely.
at home therapy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely on the same page there. You know, I guess this does lead to kind of our bigger discussion about these anti-amyloid therapies. I want to talk about the recent Cochrane review that came out about a month ago and its findings, which were somewhat controversial. But first, I want to hear your opinion on the currently available anti-amyloid therapies, both from an efficacy and safety perspective, as someone who actually works with these patients. What's your spiel?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we currently have two therapies that have been approved and that are, you know, widely available, lecanemab and donanemab. Efficacy-wise, I think they're fairly comparable if you're, you know, looking at the same population and the same clinical tests. You're looking at about a 27 to 29% a slowing of the rate of decline of slowing in the rate of cognitive decline with either therapy. So that translates to about, you know, 5 months over 18 months. So not hugely robust. They're not curative, but it seems to be doing something. And you know, long-term data does seem to suggest that that effect is cumulative. These aren't benign therapies, though. You know, they of course come with risks, ARIA being the main concerning risk, to amyloid-related imaging abnormalities that comes with these therapies. Donanemab perhaps has a higher rates of ARIA compared to lecanemab, though with a modified titration that's been introduced, which we use at our center, it seems the rates are a little bit more comparable. The ARIA-H rates are a little higher. You know, I think anecdotally, like what we're seeing in practice in these patients is, you know, it does seem like each visit before these therapies were introduced, patients were, or their caregivers were reporting there's some kind of a decline. We still have that reported to us, but it doesn't seem to be as consistent or common as it was once before. So, you know, that's very, very subjective, right? And then, of course, this is not placebo control. This is just purely what the patients are telling us. So there is something to be said about that, I think. But it is more reassuring than what we once thought, I think, when these therapies first hit the market, of everybody's like, I don't touch.
Yeah, and as you guys in clinic gain more experience, you know, if you had to describe kind of the general patient population that the providers are most likely going to recommend, you know, talk to you about starting one of these therapies, what is that patient looking like in a general sense?
Yeah, I mean, so most of these patients, I think mean age somewhere between 60 and 70 years. They're definitely very early in their disease course. You know, mild cognitive impairments, mild Alzheimer's disease. They're often very independent still. They're still high functioning. You know, you can talk to them for a couple minutes and actually not even realize that they have any kind of dementia. It's only after you have that continuous conversation that you start to notice, so they're asking the same questions over and over again. They don't seem to quite be following the progression of the conversation. You know, so I think these are the types of patients we're looking at. We tend to avoid, you know, particularly older patients with several other comorbidities. Up until recently, we were also avoiding patients who were ApoE homozygous because we were concerned about the increased ARIA risk and increased severity of ARIA in that population. Though as we've gained a little bit more confidence and comfort, and we've actually seen what our population looks like in terms of ARIA rates, we have gotten a little bit more comfortable. If the patient and their caregiver understand the risk, then we might proceed with therapy in that population. But that's still very rare. Yeah. So that's generally the population we work with.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty consistent with what we saw as far as positive data in the trials, and also what I, you know, what I kind of see happening here, although I'm not like heavily involved in the space myself. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's just really cool. Like I said, not a lot of pharmacists, at least in my review, have a chance to be involved in this space and to be able to discuss these drugs with potential patients. And I think it's just so hugely important that you're involved in this space and that patients have that resource in your clinic. Now, anything that you make sure to discuss with them, and how often do you find that your discussion, you know, might sway a patient's decision, maybe one way or another?
That's a great question. So I do try to hit all the high points and make sure that I'm, you know, setting expectations with patients during the visits. I think as pharmacists, that's a very important role that we play. So what is it going to look like in terms of efficacy, you know, ensuring that they understand this is not curative. The decline that's already happened is not going to reverse. These patients are going to continue to decline. All we're doing is slowing the rate of decline. And that's going to look differently from person A to person B. It may not be that noticeable. So I establish those kind of expectations up front. And I do emphasize the, you know, reality of ARIA in that it can occur, it's expected to occur within the first 3 to 6 months of therapy. In most cases, it's mild to moderate. It resolves on its own, but it can be severe and it has led to deaths in patients. And I do highlight, you know, thrombolytic risks as well. So if someone comes in and they have stroke-like symptoms, which ARIA-E and ARIA-H could certainly look like a stroke, a mimic, focal neurologic deficits, et cetera, you don't want to expose a patient to thrombolytics because that can lead to poor outcomes and fatalities. There have been a couple of case reports already published with each therapy following exposure to thrombolytics that led to a multifocal intraparenchymal hemorrhage and death. So those are the big, you know, high points, also highlighting what is actually involved in the infusion and setting those expectations that they understand they need to get these MRIs at these particular time points. Generally speaking, you know, when I talk to these patients in terms of swaying their decision one way or another, I have patients that come to me, majority are undecided, but there are quite a few that are, I want to do this therapy because there's nothing else left. Or there's other options for me. And so, you know, when I have those conversations and discussion, oftentimes it kind of gets them to back up a little bit and say, okay, let me talk about it with my husband or my spouse, my wife. Let me talk about it with my children and make sure that this is something that I actually want to proceed with. And just providing that context and understanding so that patients can make the informed decision to the best of their ability based on what information that they have. And I try to give it all to them. So that's generally how it goes usually with these types of discussions.
Yeah, I think your high points are definitely, you know, informed decision making and expectation setting, which I think is just so universal in our role, especially as clinic pharmacists.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so on to this Cochrane review. So for anyone who it's a long thing. It's over like 50 pages. So we'll try and give a summary to anyone who doesn't have 50 pages of time in their day. So it's titled Amyloid Beta Targeting Monoclonal Antibodies for People with Mild Cognitive Impairment or Mild Dementia Due to Alzheimer's Disease. So it came out to quite the buzz at the end of April. And now that things have settled a little bit, maybe I want to talk about it a bit. So I'll just read again. These are the author's conclusions. This is directly quoted, again, for anyone who doesn't have the chance to read. Quote, the effect of amyloid beta targeting monoclonal antibodies on cognitive function and dementia severity at 18 months in people with mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease is trivial, while on functional ability, it is small at best. Amyloid beta targeting monoclonal antibodies increase the risk of amyloid-related imaging abnormalities. Both desirable outcomes and adverse events were inconsistently reported in the studies included in the review. Successful removal of amyloid from the brain does not seem to be associated with clinically meaningful effects in people with mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. Future research on disease-modifying treatments for Alzheimer's disease should focus on other mechanisms of action. So, Milan, your initial thoughts after reading this review?
I think it does address a very important question of, you know, safety, efficacy. You know, we think about cost with these therapies. So it does try to address an important question. I do think the verbiage is a little
aggressive.
Aggressive. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah. To say like these medications are, you know, bunk, they're nonsense.
Yeah, just like let it go, focus on stuff.
Yeah. And you know, when you look at the study and evaluate, there are some pretty glaring limitations of the way it was designed. What anti-amyloid therapies are actually included in the analysis, which were all of the agents that have been evaluated, and there are some pretty distinctive differences between each of them, that I think it's not quite fair to look at that and say that these aren't effective as a class. And of course, the duration of the study and actually the inclusion criteria was a little bit different, especially earlier on. You didn't see patients, not all of the studies had a requirement that patients actually had to be amyloid positive. So they didn't have to show these patients are amyloid positive, maybe because the studies were so early, we didn't have that testing available. It wasn't widely available. So if your patient's not amyloid positive, then these therapies, of course, are not going to work. So you may have some of these areas that I think, I wish they had used maybe a little bit different phrasing and verbiage that wasn't so strong, about this class of therapies.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next point, because I've seen a lot of commentary on the inclusion of all of the anti-amyloid therapies and not just the ones that are currently approved or available for use. So things like aducanumab, which was, the first one approved, which is now gone from the market. And I think you already kind of touched on, based on, yes, the title of the review says it's a class-wide thing, and so you should include everything in the class. But we've gone so far down the line with these agents that a study on aducanumab looks very different than a study on donanemab or some of the newer ones. I feel like we have learned a ton along the way about these patients and appropriate things to study and appropriate inclusion criteria. I agree with you there. As someone who's not an expert on these, I see kind of both sides. I think maybe they could have targeted their review to be maybe a little bit more helpful and have a little bit different conclusions.
and kind of along the same lines, I mean, when you look at some of the earlier anti-amyloid therapies that were evaluated and studied, and they're targeting different life, the different phases of the life of the amyloid beta and the plaque. So, amyloid beta gets cleaved and it forms these monomers and then oligomers, protofibrils, fibrils, which eventually become the plaque. But these therapies are targeting different phases of the plaque. So donanemab is targeting the plaque itself. Lecanemab targets the soluble protofibrils and fibrils. Some of the earlier therapies are targeting those monomers and oligomers. And actually, if you look at the studies, they did not achieve adequate amyloid clearance. So that could in part explain why we maybe didn't see as robust of a treatment effect or treatment response. There are certainly differences. And I think that, I don't know how else I would necessarily design the study, if I was going to include all of the anti-amyloid therapies, but at least highlighting that there is a there's a difference in the degree of clearance that you get with these therapies based on the mechanism. And that does seem to affect clinical outcomes that maybe should have been highlighted a little bit more, made a little bit more clear.
Yeah. Another commentary that I saw is the idea that this review and kind of that conclusion is perhaps premature, that we need more long-term data to demonstrate the full value of amyloid targeting therapies, and we just don't have that yet. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you look at Alzheimer's pathology and the progression of disease, I mean, it tends to follow a sigmoidal curve. So early in the disease, you have this kind of, you know, I say more a modest decline that, like, you know, you're talking to these patients. This is where the ones that are starting treatment, right? They're earlier in the disease. So we don't expect to see a very rapid or accelerated decline at that point. It's not until, you know, 3 years plus afterwards that they reach that middle stage of the disease, the middle to late stage of disease, where the acceleration of decline, the rate of decline begins to accelerate. So those patients start to drop off more. So maybe these early studies at the 18-month mark are not capturing that difference in decline. And so we're not seeing a hugely robust difference. What we are seeing is that at about 36 months, we have data now. I think I'm sure we'll see the 48-month and onward data too. But they're starting to, they're continuing to see a separation between the treated and untreated patients in these open label extensions. So that gap continues to widen. And that was what was postulated early. If we can clear the plaque out early on of the disease, we can prevent further decline and we can maintain and preserve function. Now, these patients continue to decline, but the rate of decline seems to be slower. It'll be interesting as we kind of get into that next phase of disease, how that difference continues to grow. Are these people going to continue to decline? Do they drop off or do they maintain? Having the cutoff at 18 months may have been a little bit premature. We are seeing that data now that there is a separation occurring too.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like overall this review, perhaps changed your opinion on these therapies. Do you think it changed the opinions of any of the providers that you work with?
Not really. I think we all have the same mindset of, you know, when these therapies first came out, we wanted to be as careful and cautious as possible in terms of who we were selecting, who we're offering this therapy to, and having very clear cut inclusion exclusion, just like a clinical trial. And that's still the case. We recognize that these therapies carry risks. We're very serious about monitoring patients throughout therapy and ensuring that they're being treated appropriately and managed appropriately. You know, we do see some benefit, and the long-term data is supportive of that. And so I think, you know, it's not something that we were going to stop offering for anybody because of this Cochrane review.
Fair enough. And just to wrap up our talk on anti-amyloids, like, I know that no one has a crystal ball here, but what do you see as kind of the future of these drugs? I hear talk of things like using biomarkers in more routine practice or using these drugs potentially as primary prevention. I mean, really potentially like a huge scaling up of this space. Is that what you see coming down, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is an area that continues to evolve. And, you know, like someone told me once when I first got into pharmacy, they're like, you know, 50% of everything we know is wrong. We just don't know what 50%. And I feel like, you know, I'm saying all this stuff now, and maybe in 6 months I'll be eating my words. I don't know.
This will be available forever. So
yeah, it'll live on forever. So people will be like, that Milad, he's like poop. The things that you know are kind of on the horizon. I think blood-based biomarkers as a more convenient alternative to these amyloid PET scans and CSF testing, which we no longer really do CSF as much anymore. We used to kind of do the amyloid PET, imaging testing, but you know, that could certainly play a role, not necessarily as the final say or the gold standard, but, you know, out in the community where you may not have access to the MRIs and advanced testing, it might be a useful, you know, kind of screening or step up tool. There are other therapies coming out or that are currently being investigated, looking at tau and these microtubules and seeding the plaque that maybe can supplement anti-amyloid therapy. I think there was a gene silencer that was evaluated. I don't think it met its secondary or primary endpoint. So they might go back to the drawing board, but you know, stabilizing agents. So potentially someone with ApoE that's a homozygous, maybe you don't want to try to clear the plaque, but if you can catch them early on, Maybe you can stabilize the amyloid beta and prevent those plaques from forming. But you can identify a homozygous very early on, right? They have the gene. I think that's going to be a very interesting area that's going to hopefully continue to evolve and grow. And yeah, the field is changing rapidly, and it's a very exciting time to be involved in it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for your expertise. I feel like you've added so much value for our listeners. So I want to thank you so much for that. I always like to end a discussion, though, with a little work-life balance. I think I said in the last episode, that's important in life and in working on this podcast. So can you share somewhere cool, either nearby or far away, that you have visited and what you enjoyed about it?
So my wife and I, we like to travel when we can. Fairly recently, this last place we went to was St. John in the Caribbean. And it's awesome. It's gorgeous, beautiful place, lovely food, lovely people. It's wild, you know, like you drive a Jeep around, the roads are all kind of messed up. And
it's a cool experience.
It's super cool. And the beaches are pristine, like a swimming pool. They're warm and you can see to the bottom. And so I was snorkeling for the first time. And that is, I don't know if you've gone snorkeling before.
Yeah, but it's probably a totally different experience for in a place like that with such pristine water.
You can see all the way to the bottom. You see the coral. You see all these like wacky, wild looking fish swimming around in schools and they're feeding. It's a very, immersive experience. I'm looking forward to getting my like scuba certification so I can actually go down in there and do the diving. But St. John, highly, highly suggest if you can make it out there. It's awesome. Awesome place.
Well, very cool. Yeah, I'm going to start to make a list because... Yeah, I mentioned last episode, I have two small children, so I'm working up the courage to like just stay in a hotel room with them because I'm too nervous about waking them up.
Start small, yeah.
Starting very small, about 40 minutes away. Staycation.
Flights would freak me out with little children, but
yeah. Yep, as they should. But I will report back.
Yeah.
And definitely live vicariously through. That sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on and for your discussion and for your expertise and for all the amazing work you do for your patients day to day. It sounds amazing.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Take care.
Tune in monthly for more episodes of Mind the Meds, and have a great day, week one.